Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, I'm delighted to present to you, Luke Burgess is an entrepreneur and author who has co-created and led four companies in wellness, consumer products and technology. He is managing partner of Fourth Wall Ventures, an incubator that he founded to build, train and invest in people and companies that contribute to a healthy human ecology. He is also a recognized expert in French thinker René Girard's mimetic theory. On this podcast, Luke discusses mimetic desire, how people unconsciously want what others want and therefore value jobs, spouses, brands, moral viewpoints and even themselves according to the desires of others. He describes this phenomenon, which has been exploited by internet trolls, politicians and ad agencies, in his new book, Wanting, The Power of Mimetic Desire in Everyday Life. Luke also talks about how the future depends on what we learn to want today and how best to cultivate desires that are authentic for each of us. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where my scientific director, Megan Hall, answers questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, attend live, as well as listen to all the replays covering everything from low-dose naltrexone to high red blood cells. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to nbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's nbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's episode with Luke Burgess. Well, Luke, thank you so much for joining me this morning. How are you doing?
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me on. I am doing really well. It's a beautiful day here in Princeton, New Jersey, where I happen to be.
Oh, I envy you. You would have thought that being in Santa Cruz in Northern California in June, I would be seeing the sunshine, but apparently not. It's actually raining. So I am inside recording the podcast for maybe the first time ever in June. Well, actually, it's the second time. But you can't complain. It's still better than the British summer.
That's right. That's right.
So I first became familiar with your work on mimesis and your new book, Wanting, through our mutual friend, Ryan Nicodemus, who is one half of The Minimalists. I'm very privileged and I get some fantastic introductions through him.
Absolutely.
And I was already familiar with the work of René Girard, vaguely, I should say, because I have another super smart friend. His name's Jeremy Hendon. And he studied rhetoric at Berkeley. And he chose Violence and Sacred for our book club, which was quite an experience, I'll say. I don't think anybody apart from Jeremy actually finished the book.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, so I respect him a lot. And I knew there were likely very important ideas in the book. And even though I couldn't, I'll tell you what it was like when I was reading this book. It was like, you know, I'm a computer scientist and I understand programming languages. And there's this thing we call syntax, which I know might be something different from what you commonly understand. But think of syntax as the sort of characters and tokens of the code. And then from that emerges the semantics, right? And so it was like the syntax was passing, but there were no semantics. Like I couldn't get any meaning out of this book. So in the end, I went onto YouTube and I watched a bunch of interviews with Girard and then also a bunch of theologians talking about his work and the importance of it. And maybe we'll get a bit later, we'll get into why a theologian would be interested in Girard's work. So tell me about your story. Like, you know, I like to start my interviews with start with why. And since reading your book, I've realized that maybe that's a mistake, right? But start with your story of, with Fit Fuel and the trajectory that you were on and how you became interested in mimesis and Girard's story.
Sure. Yeah, Violence and the Sacred is a really hard book to read, by the way. I included a list of next steps for people that finish Wanting and that want to dive deeper into René Girard. You'll notice that Violence and the Sacred is not even on the top 10 list.
I did notice that.
Because I just think it's a very difficult book to read. I mean, I find the syntax strange. The way that Girard writes, he could be very obscure. And that's the kind of book I've had to read 5, 6, 7 times in order to be able to find meaning and make sense of it. And that was one of the last books that I got to in the Girardian corpus. So I'll go about all the way back to the beginning, which is your question. You know, how did this happen? What was the why behind my interest in Girard and why I wrote this book. I was a serial entrepreneur in my 20s. I quit a job on Wall Street when I was, my career on Wall Street lasted less than a year. It was not for me. And moved to California and was in the startup world for all of my 20s, really. And started a series of companies, some successful, some not so successful. Some I just got bored of and walked away. One of those companies was FitFuel.com. It was strange story, actually. I started a healthy vending machine company. We quite literally just took health foods and put them into vending machines because we couldn't figure out, you know, vending machines seem like a good delivery mechanism. They make food accessible when you need it the most, like in airports and office buildings, when you just need a little snack. And we couldn't figure out why they were only filled with junk food. So the idea was super simple. Why don't we just take granola bars, pita chips, the healthy alternative, and put it in a vending machine, brand them really well, and we'll have a business. So that was actually one of the very first companies that I ever started. And we became a distributor of all of the products that go in the vending machines. We didn't want to operate the machines. We just found vending machine operators and say, hey, wouldn't you like to offer healthy snacks in your machines? That turned into us becoming a very large distributor of healthy snacks and foods, which turned into an online store. So the vending machine business, actually, we spun off a totally separate company called FitFuel.com, where we just sold all of these healthy snacks at retail, direct to consumer, rather than through the vending distribution channel. So that was the company, and we grew very quickly. The online e-commerce company grew, it ended up becoming larger than the vending business that we had. So I started to focus more and more on FitFuel. And I moved the company from Southern California to Las Vegas. I was essentially a tax refugee. Moved to Vegas, not really knowing what to find there. I mean, I wanted a party for sure. And I'd made the trips, you know, to play a little blackjack and poker on the weekends. And I moved the company primarily for business reasons. Real estate was a lot cheaper. And met Tony Hsieh, who is the former and unfortunately late CEO of Zappos.com. And he and I got into sort of merger and acquisition talks. Turns out that Zappos had just built a thriving business in shoes. They were looking to move beyond shoes to find their next billion-dollar vertical. They identified our company culture as being kind of similar to theirs, and we talked about joining forces. And that deal ended up falling through, to make a really long and complicated story short, at the very last minute, because this was in 2008. So the deal fell through after we'd already went out and celebrated the deal. The board essentially changed their mind the next day. And I had a series of complex emotions after hearing the news that the deal was off. I knew that my company was, we had some cash flow issues in 2008 because we were overleveraged. So I knew that we were in trouble. But I also felt this feeling of relief wash over me that the very day that I learned of this news. And I knew that there was something strange going on. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And it had to do with why I wanted the things that I wanted. Like, why is it that, I'm 26, 27 years old. I've started 4 companies at this point. I never seem to be satisfied with anything that I do, even having achieved a decent amount of financial freedom, friends, top 25 entrepreneur under 25. I did everything that I set out to do when I quit my job on Wall Street. Just totally unsatisfied. And I thought to myself, Luke, if you don't figure out what's behind this never satisfied ambition and striving of yours, you risk being miserable for the rest of your life. You risk in terms of your relationships, you risk like never being in a happy marriage. Like, you've got to figure out what's driving you. And this search eventually led me to René Girard, led me to take some time off from my startups. I was like, Luke, you just need to take 3 or 6 months and just be still for once in your life. Read, hike, travel, just take some time to do some introspection. And that's what I did. And it was during that period of discernment that I came across the ideas of René Girard, in particular, his concept of mimetic desire. And it really gave me insight, first, really to understand some of the things going on in the world, the kind of herd mentality and you know, what was causing a lot of the things going on in the stock market, bubbles and all of those things. And then I began to see it in myself. And I know we haven't really defined the term yet, but mimetic desire really helped me explain what was behind some of the pursuits that I was undertaking, which often led to just total disillusionment.
Wow, what a fantastic story. What incredible insight. You know, I love your analogy, social gravity, what gravity is to physics, mimetic desire is to psychology. It's an idea that is so simple and so profound, you would have thought it's self-evident, but apparently it is not. Otherwise, you wouldn't have read this book. You know, I've kind of understood it for a while just through experience of having kids. So if you take two similar age kids and you put them in a room full of toys, one of the kids will invariably pick up a toy first, and guess what the second kid wants? It's the toy that the first kid picked up. And then conflict ensues. And you know, I'm sure you can explain all of this, but in your words, explain to us, what is mimetic desire?
Mimetic desire is wanting something because other people want it first, or we perceive that other people want something. That's actually an important distinction. You know, we spend a lot of our life projecting and guessing what's in other people's heads and what their desires are. And very often we're wrong. So I should be very clear about that. Like, if we perceive that others desire something, it imbues that object or that person or whatever it is with some kind of special value for us. So value is a very subjective thing for humans. And mimetic is a fancy word for imitation that René Girard used. So he said, in essence, that human desire is largely, perhaps all, mimetic. In other words, we look to other people to know what to want, and we imitate their desires. And that this process of forming desires by taking other people as models of desire usually happens as an entirely unconscious process. We don't realize that we're subtly taking cues from other people or groups around us all of the time, because we have this idea that our desires are independent and spontaneous and totally our own all of the time. We convince ourselves of that. We're hyper-individualists and rational, so that, you know, I want this thing because I've done the research and it is objectively the best. Denying the social process through which desire is formed. And that's Girard's argument, is that we're social creatures. And he put his finger on something that most people miss. And that's that our desires are generated and shaped in the relationship between people, not out of some secret organ of desire that we have inside of ourselves.
Well, the reason I say this should be self-evident, I think there's a really nice word that encapsulates this, which is the word Ubuntu. And for the last 20 years of my life, I thought Ubuntu was a Linux distribution that I very much enjoyed and have been using a lot, both personally and professionally. And then a couple of years ago, like, what does the word Ubuntu mean anyway? And Ubuntu means a person is a person through other persons. Right, like our entire humanity is shared. So is our desires not just part of that humanity? Is this not self-evident?
I think that it is. I think that Girard's work is not one of the hard sciences. I do think it's self-evident. And our personhood is constituted in and through our relationships, you know, beginning with our parents and then the relationships that we develop through life. So in a certain sense, the idea of the self cannot be understood in without relation to other selves. So it is. I mean, when you understand this about yourself, understanding mimetic desire comes very naturally. And it's also like not threatening. I think some people find the idea of having mimetic desire, having your desires in some way be derivative of others, to be maybe embarrassing or something that we try to hide out of shame or something like that. Because we always want to be the first mover. You know, we want to pursue something on our own and hope other people follow us. I mean, Girard, if you understand Girard correctly, he's kind of changed my understanding of leadership too. Because every leader is in some sense being led in some way through mimetic desire. So I think this opens up a fascinating perspective on what it means to be human.
Yeah, I wonder if it's because we're too close. You know, like there's an old saying that it's hard to read the label when you're inside the jar. And maybe that's true here of mimetic desire.
Yeah, it's something that's not necessarily out there. like a technology to be manipulated, coded, debugged, hacked. And I think that's a temptation for a lot of people when they first learn about mimetic desire. It's like, well, how can I use this to make money in crypto? Or how can I use this to build a company? I think you can, if you understand this force, this phenomenon and how it works, you can make sense of movements in markets and movements in relationships, right? Because it is a psychological force that's kind of like what gravity is to physics. But if you stay there, if it's only something that's external to you, you miss the fact that this is also something that's inside of you. And as you say, with some of the things that are most obvious, we're too close to see. It's kind of like I don't know if you've seen David Foster Wallace, This Is Water, you know, the fish swimming along, like what the hell is water?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I was getting at. Exactly. I had the opportunity to talk to another friend who I believe is a mutual friend of Ryan Nicodemus. In fact, I know he is because he made the introduction. That's Chris Ryan. He's the author of Sex at Dawn and Civilized to Death, two books I've very much enjoyed also. And, you know, I explained the central thesis of the book. Chris hadn't read it yet. He was planning to, I believe. And I hope I didn't misrepresent it. I'm pretty sure I didn't. But anyway, his first question is one I think you address in the book. In fact, I know you do, which is, well, how do you distinguish between biological needs and desires? Like, how would you make that distinction?
That's a really tricky question. And I think we should be careful about trying to make the distinctions, because I think one of the points, and maybe I didn't emphasize this enough in the book, I hope I did, is that they often blend together. So take something like sexuality. I haven't read the book yet, but I understand the premise, I think. So take something like sexuality. Certainly there is a biological drive, or there's a sexual urge and libido, which is necessary on the level of the species, but not on the level of the individual person. And within sexuality, so there is an instinct, there's an instinctual basis and drive and things going on the biological level, and we can study that through science. It's also, it bleeds into mimetic phenomena too. So our sexuality can be influenced through mimesis or through mimetic desire, whether that's choices of partners, types of sex we engage in. It's like, in other words, I think it's wrong to try to draw a fine line and say, okay, all of these things over here, food, drink, sex, comfort, bodily needs, those are needs. And then everything else is desire. I think that in our daily experience, the mimesis kind of permeates pretty much everything.
I would agree with that. It is very tricky to define. You know, I put forward to Chris Ryan, maybe the distinction I got from Emily Nagoski, which is, you know, with a need, if you don't fulfill it, there is tissue damage, right? So if I don't get food or water or air, then tissue damage occurs. However, that's not true of sexual desire, right? Like there's no tissue damage if you don't get laid. But Chris is like points out that there's still biological processes that go on. So for example, in a man, he continues to make semen and then he starts to have wet dreams, right? Like if he doesn't have sex. So like, it's super dicey to try and tease apart what is a need and what is a desire.
Right. Yeah. I like to think of it as falling on a spectrum, you know, where there may not be, well, I think there are some things that fall almost entirely on the mimetic side of the spectrum. Like very abstract, like goals and you know, things that people want, you know, very kind of like obscure things that have, you know, sort of a product of our modern day economy. We come up with all kinds of things that, you know, are all of a sudden desirable that weren't 5-6 years ago. But I think it's a spectrum, and some things have very little kind of like biological basis to them and might fall more in the realm of desire. And vice versa. There are some things like if I'm locked outside of my house in the wintertime, I don't know how much mimetic desire is involved in me just wanting to get back into the warmth inside of the house, right? So that might fall on the other side of the spectrum, something that is a little more hardwired. I have this instinctual response to get the hell out of the cold.
I feel like if I put you in an fMRI scanner, I'd be able to answer that question, right? Like if it's been driven by the hypothalamus, then it's probably a need. But if it's not in the hypothalamus, it's probably a desire.
Right, right, right.
Talk about Peter Thiel's bet on Facebook. It seems like that his understanding of mimesis led him to the insight that Facebook was going to be very valuable.
So René Girard was a mentor of Peter Thiel while Thiel was an undergrad philosophy student at Stanford in the late 80s. Never his teacher. Girard didn't teach in the philosophy department, but Thiel sought him out and would attend little circles that Girard had. So really absorbed a lot of his thinking. And from what I understand, they got to be quite close to the point where Peter attended Girard's funeral when he died in 2015. I think he even gave a talk. So they became close throughout Girard's life. And, you know, Peter was heavily influenced by this. I think it helped him understand himself. It helped him answer some questions about religion. And it helped him in practical ways, too. I think Peter is one of the people that has taken mimetic theory and tried to apply it in very practical ways. I think even down to the way that he makes investment decisions and the way that he led PayPal in the early days. And he does credit Girard and his understanding of mimetic desire as one of the things that allowed him to see the vast potential of Facebook. And, you know, for those that don't know the story, Thiel was, this is depicted in the film, The Social Network, Thiel was the first outside investor in Facebook. He gave Mark Zuckerberg and team $500,000 and was the first one in. And we look back on that and we say, well, obviously, right? But I mean, at the time, you know, there were already some social networks out there, and it wasn't obvious that Facebook was going to do so well. But he saw the way that the mimesis was fueling the growth of Facebook. And he sort of saw, he bet on Facebook. And in his words to me were, I bet on mimesis. He saw the way that once Facebook was on a particular campus, beginning with the Ivy Leagues, when one student or a group of students began to use the platform, it spread by mimetic contagion to the rest of that campus in an extraordinarily quick period of time. I don't know the exact number. I want to say it's something like within 30 days, 90% of the students were on the platform. Just crazy. And in Peter's mind, that was a product of mimetic desire.
Well, what about impression management, though? You know, I think that resident performance psychologist Simon Marshall has been very helpful in pointing out that social media, especially Facebook, is impression management software. So, you know, taking the ancestral heritage view of things, like obviously the need to belong to your tribe was a matter of life and death. Therefore, what people were saying about you was extremely important and you would pay special attention to that. Well, that's exactly what Facebook is tapping into, right? Like that's the reason people keep coming back, is because what other people are saying about you is especially salient. Wouldn't you agree?
I absolutely agree with that. So, I mean, I don't think that Facebook invented anything new. I think like people were already doing this, right? Like we already looked to models to know what to want in the form of other people. We already cared what other people were saying for the reasons that you just described. Facebook just accelerated all of these things. Like it tapped into this primal need that we have. And I don't know if we quite realize what it's doing to us. I mean, it may have been you have a tribe, you have a small group of friends in your secondary school, wherever you grew up, who are the people that you look to. Well, now all of a sudden we have hundreds of millions, even billions of people. So there's been this real hypertrophy of mimetic desire in my view. And that's what makes it such a powerful drug.
And this has important implications that I think are not unique to Facebook. You write about in the book how Stanford or any university system is a sort of homogenizing machine. You know, people come in wanting a variety of different things and everybody comes out wanting exactly the same thing, right? Like I've seen that too at university. And this has a tendency to create conflict. But, you know, I was wondering if you talk about that and the implications for Facebook, right? Because it has very different reach from just one university campus network.
Yeah, it's interesting with the university. You know, if you survey the incoming freshmen and you ask them what they want to do after college, you'll get a vast range of answers, just a really great variety. And then if you survey them again when they're seniors, especially in an undergrad business school for whatever reason, which I attended, by the way, you tend to find that the desires or the career paths have converged onto a handful of things usually, maybe even the same company. And that's mimetic desire. It's you know, that's a powerful force that shapes what people want in this kind of social hotbed of university. in terms of social, and that creates conflict, right? So now there were 2,000 different things that people wanted to do when they came in. Now they've converged on, you know, a dozen, and they're competing with each other fiercely for those spots. So mimetic desire inherently leads to some conflict, because if we want what other people want, then they're just our rivals, and we're competing with them if it's a scarce good, like most jobs are. Facebook, you know, encourages this, or any of the social media platforms, frankly, encourage this, and they profit off it, frankly. The more that people are rivals on the platforms, the more that they're arguing about something, the more that they want the same things. And on social media platforms, that's engagement, it's followers, it's authority, it's retweets, it's all of those things. The more inherent conflict there is as people begin to compete with one another for the same accolades, for the same status. And it's the platform that profits, right? I mean, the more that two sides in a political argument are arguing on a Facebook thread, you know, that's kind of probably going to be a zero-sum game for them, but it's not for Facebook. Because as long as that discussion or that rivalry or that conflict is happening on the platform, then it's engagement. And that's a good thing for the company.
Yeah, zero-sumness. That's the important point, isn't it? That, you know, if the object of the desire is a zero-sum game, like a pie, you know, there's only so much pie to go around. If two people want it, then I cut it in half. Eventually, there's going to be no pie left. That's the condition, the zero-sumness that creates conflict.
Right. And there are some goods that are scarce, and there are others that are not, that you know, can be shared by all. And I think of things like virtues, things that if you have more, then it doesn't mean that I have to have less.
Like love.
Like love. Exactly. Yep. So, you know, that I think we have to differentiate. Mimetic desire gets particularly nasty when it's over something scarce, or when it's over something abstract like prestige or status, because that is, you know, the Latin word for prestige, prestigium, literally means illusion. It's this great movie with Christian Bale in it called The Prestige, and about two illusionists. And it's, you know, the idea of prestige or status or these abstract things that people pine for so much, those are also very dangerous, because there's just no end. Like, when is enough enough?
So I don't want you to quiz me on Girard, because I'm going to fall on my face pretty fast. But I understand that it was this conflict that, you know, Girard makes this distinction between good violence and bad violence. Can you explain that?
Well, it's actually, he's saying that we make the distinction between good violence and bad violence, and that's the crux of the problem. He says human beings always justify their own violence as being good, as, for instance, as a just retaliation to an aggressor. So he says our violence is always good and the enemy's violence is always bad in our minds. And he says, I don't know if I'd call Girard a pacifist, but it wouldn't be a stretch to say that. He says, listen, all violence is bad. And because we have this distinction in our minds that there's good violence and bad violence, we perpetuate cycles of violence. And a large part of Girard's corpus of work is talking about scapegoats and the scapegoat mechanism. It's the way that a community or culture in crisis throughout history has tended to resolve that crisis, where they unite against one person or one group, in essence, transfer the blame onto this entity and expel, exterminate, kill the scapegoat. And there's an ancient Jewish ritual in which they did this with a literal goat. And, you know, we've substituted all kinds of things for goats throughout history. So Girard says that the reason that we do that is that humans seem to have a fundamental belief that the solution for violence is violence. And if you think about the way that the scapegoat mechanism works, somebody or a group is targeted as the cause of the problem and eliminated. It's essentially using violence to drive out violence. And Girard said that is where we get ourselves into trouble. We always think that the scapegoat is guilty, and if we just eliminate this one cell in the body, that everything will be fine. But in fact, we're using violence against a person or against a group in order to do that.
Ah, now that's interesting, because I thought the distinction good versus bad violence was the bad violence was the one-on-one conflict and the good violence was scapegoating. And I thought that was Girard's argument against Christianity, was that, you know, all religions engaged in scapegoating, including Christianity in the beginning, but then Christ died on the cross and they sort of drew a line under it, no more scapegoating, thus, you know, eliminating the possibility of good violence. But maybe that was my misinterpretation.
Yeah, so Girard says that we do think that our violence against others, what he calls a mimetic crisis, when we're engaged in this kind of war of all against all, we think that that's bad violence, and that we save ourselves from this kind of war of all against all by uniting against a scapegoat, and that we believe that that's good violence, but in fact, it's all bad. And his view of Christianity actually was positive. I mean, Girard was a Christian, and he said, listen, throughout history, societies have killed scapegoats, and it's the scapegoat brings this illusory sense of peace. The act of uniting against a scapegoat is cathartic. It brings catharsis. It unites formerly warring people together. And in his view, what happened with the crucifixion was that the people had always sort of believed that the scapegoat was guilty. And he said the crucifixion revealed that the scapegoat was pretty clearly innocent in the case of Christ, and that unmasked the scapegoat mechanism, not like once and for all, but he said, you know, it basically became less effective. Humanity began to see the mirror was turned back on humanity, and people began to see that the scapegoat mechanism is we're violent, and we can do violence against innocent people. And so it is in a sense exposed. And he said, because of that, Christianity has created, in a sense, and it's done a good thing by revealing the scapegoat mechanism. In another sense, it stripped the power that the scapegoat mechanism used to have in societies before it. Does that make sense? I know that's kind of this is one of the hardest parts of Girard, I think, to understand.
Okay. Well, I'm glad it's not just me feeling a bit dumb, but that did make sense. Yes, thank you. I mean, that's the value that you're bringing to the table here. These are really important ideas, but the original sources are not very accessible. So we need someone like you to make it digestible to someone like me.
That's why I wrote the book. And you know, in writing a book, as you know, like when you have to teach something or when you have to write something, you learn it much better yourself.
You really have to understand it, right?
You really have to understand it. In the very process of trying, it's like when I teach classes. I learn more by teaching than I ever learned by being a student, for sure.
That's amazing. You present a couple of dichotomies in the book, which I really enjoyed and thought had great explanatory power. One is Celebristan versus Freshmanistan. Can you explain that?
So Girard identified two major kinds of mimetic models, meaning the people that we look to that shape our desires. In both cases, pretty unconsciously, but in one case, more unconsciously than the other. So the two different kinds of models are the kind is outside of our world, that we have no possibility of coming into contact with. There's no possibility of rivalry. These people could be dead. They could just exist in a different social sphere, a different part of the world. He calls those external models, external mediators of desire. And in the book, my shorthand for them is they live in a world called Celebristan. You know, these are celebrities where there's some kind of a boundary between us and them. The other kind of a model is, and by the way, the models that are in Celebristan, we call these role models for children. We typically imitate them fairly openly. We're not ashamed. These are people that can be imitated. The other kind of model is in our world. They're people that we come into contact with, or at the very least, we have the possibility of coming into contact or conflict with them or rivalry. So I call this war, and this is Girard calls these internal mediators of desire. I call that this world Freshmanistan in the book, because it's like being a freshman at university or like a freshman in high school. You've got a bunch of people that are all very similar. Same age, kind of the same boat, same situation in life. They can all come into contact with everybody else. So they're all internal mediators of desire for one another. None of them stand apart. None of them are kind of outside the domain of the others. And one of the arguments I make in the book is that one of the things social media has done, for instance, is kind of made us all internal mediators of desire to one another. it's kind of like taken us all, you know, through technology and put us existentially speaking on the head of a pin. Whereas before, people could be at a distance, no possibility of coming into contact with them. Now, even people that 10 years ago I may have considered a celebrity, I can DM them on Instagram and might even get a response from them. We're all just a little bit, we're in a different relationship with our fellow human beings in a way that we haven't been in throughout history.
No, that makes perfect sense. You also present the idea of thin versus thick desire. Can you explain that?
A thin desire is my just a term that I coined to try to describe the types of desires that are highly mimetic and ephemeral, here today, gone tomorrow. So I could catch the desire, and I think the pandemic really kind of inflamed a lot of us with thin desires. As we, I don't know about everybody else listening, I spent more time on social media during the pandemic than I think I had in the previous 5 years. And I think I caught a lot of thin desires by seeing things that people were doing on social media. And they're just highly mimetic. I mean, these desires didn't come from, they'd never even crossed my mind prior to like seeing a post or something like that, right? Like traveling the country in a van or getting a certain pet or, you know, some, or a certain kind of food or something like that. They lack like grounding in a sort of a deep core of my being. The thick desires are the kind that have been sort of built up over time. I think of the thin desires like leaves over layers of granite. They can be blown away with a strong gust of wind. The thick desires are the ones that have been built up, you know, throughout my life. The desire to have a family, the desires for certain kinds of meaningful work. That's the distinction. And these are less, the thick desires are less mimetic, meaning there's not somebody that's going to come into my life tomorrow and completely blow away that thick desire. It has some sense of solidity in the sense that I've built it up and cultivated that desire over a long period of time.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's almost a Bayesian approach to desirability. You know, like I'm thinking about the Instagram ad for some sneakers, you know, like you've never really wanted that ever before. But now, since you mention it, like actually, yeah, that does sound cool. I did see that other guy wearing those the other day, you know, and it's obviously a very thin thing that could be blown away as easily as it came versus the thick thing that you've been thinking about your whole life. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And I think people do this with careers all the time, or they change jobs because there was somebody at that workplace, somebody maybe that they admired who took the job or who was there, and they go for it. And then as soon as that person leaves, they leave too. You know, in other words, there was nothing inherent about the job itself. And in this kind of a situation, if the model goes, then we go too. And that kind of reveals that desire as a thin one. Whereas if that person can leave and we still want to be there, now we're talking about there's something more going on than merely a mimetic desire for the job or to be with that person or whatever it is, right? This applies to any domain of life.
Mm-hmm. So that example you just gave, is that what you would call mimetic rivalry?
It doesn't need not be mimetic rivalry.
Okay.
I mean, I'll give you an example from my own life. I left Wall Street because one of my friends on Wall Street left first and moved to Silicon Valley and became an entrepreneur. And when he left, all of a sudden, the desire in me was inflamed to leave. I was like, I got to get the hell out of here. It kind of like gave me the motivation and the impetus. He was in some way a model of desire for me. So I don't know if I would have done it if I hadn't seen him do it first. So that's power. I mean, I consider that a positive thing, by the way. You know, mimetic desire is not all negative. That's tremendously positive, right? There was a force that helped me do something I may have not done on my own, but we never became rivals. I mean, I moved to California. I was in LA. He was in Palo Alto. And the mimetic desire was there, but without the rivalry. So it can turn into that. If I had moved right down the block and joined his company or started a competitive company. But in that case, the mimetic desire led me to make a change without bringing us into conflict with one another in any way.
So how does one go about cultivating thick desires? Is there a prescriptive?
I don't know if there's a prescriptive, but I think that it starts with an awareness of everything we've been talking about, that knowing that we are mimetic creatures and that our desire, that we're influenced by models around us. We can simply begin creating some critical distance between us and the things that we want or we think we want, I mean, even questioning our desires. I mean, this is something that most people don't do. We take our desires for granted. And one of the things I hope that people read my book, you know, are able to do is just begin to think a little bit more critically and test their desires and discern them without just assuming that they're going to lead to a better place, to happiness or fulfillment. So I always kind of treat my desires as like a new person that I've met. And I don't know if they're friend or foe. I kind of need to get to know them a little bit. That's kind of the way that I think about desires until they reveal themselves to me. And some I kick around and I say, okay, like here's this new exercise program or new trendy, fashionable thing that everybody I know seems to be doing. I can test that pretty easily by like understanding like the limits of it and not understanding like how much of this is, I probably fitness, nutrition is probably not the best example, but like we can understand whether we want to invest our time and energy in cultivating a desire by understanding whether when is the end of this? Like, where does it end? Is this something that I can do for the rest of my life versus is this something that is going to be a season in my life? And like, how much do I want to invest? I mean, we can think of this with relationships with people much easier than I think we can with things like fitness. Like, where do we want to invest our time and energy?
Oh, I think it's incredibly relevant to fitness. Just think about body composition. Like, really? You want to look like that? Why do you want to look like that? Because you saw somebody on Instagram, like a bodybuilder at the end of a cut, just before they got up on stage, like, or just because you want to look good in a bikini this summer. Like, really? What's going to happen after that?
Sure. Like,
that seems kind of unsustainable to me. And then it gets even weirder when you realize that the images that you're looking at have been doctored by Photoshop, right? Like now things get really broken.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. One of the things I hope for with mimetic theory is that there's more research and empirical studies that go into this. And I would be fascinated to see one done on fitness. You know, we've both been in this industry a bit, and you know that there are trends and there are things that are falling in and out of fashion. And I would love to know and understand why people choose modalities of exercise and diets, how long they last, and just try to wrap my mind around how much of this, and you know, this wouldn't be probably a scientific, there's probably no exact answer, but like how much of this is driven by mimesis? How much of it is driven by mimetic desire?
Oh yeah, I can tell you another example. Going back to Simon Marshall, in his former days as a professor of public health, he did lots of research on a population that had recently entered the US from Mexico, where obesity was seen as a sign of affluence, right? Like if you could balance a bottle of beer on your beer belly, that meant you weren't working in the fields. And that was considered to be a sign of affluence. It was desirable, right? And so obviously this is disastrous for both metabolic and public health. And that was obviously a huge challenge versus most people like me. You know, you show them a picture of a skinny guy with, like the shape like an upside down triangle. And you're like, oh yeah, that's exactly what I want. You know, but why do I want it?
Exactly. Well, there's a fascinating study that was done in a Pacific island, and I can't recall the name, but in this specific island nation, to be called skinny is a really bad thing, right? I mean, it's viewed as healthy to be kind of robust as a man or a woman, and they were perfectly content, right? That living that way and with this kind of perception of what's beautiful and what's healthy and what's strong. In the study, TV was introduced to this island nation, and they studied what happened. And within 5 years or something like that of television introduced and people seeing these doctored models on TV, there was zero incidence of anorexia prior to the introduction of television. And anorexia and bulimia rates skyrocketed within 5 years. And so like their perception of what's beautiful and what's healthy changed in a very short period of time.
And the original way made perfect sense from an evolutionary biology perspective, right? To have a little bit of excess in case of times of scarcity makes perfect sense. You want to be able to weather the storm, right? Not be one event away from starvation.
Like, totally.
that totally makes sense. So tell me why you named your Substack, which is a fantastic read, by the way. It's read.lukeburgess.com. I will, of course, link to everything in the show notes. But why did you call your Substack anti-mimetic? Is mimesis something that we should be resisting at all costs? Like, that's the signal that you're sending me there.
Yeah, destructive mimesis, I think, is something that we want to avoid and build up some antibodies to it and build up some muscles, if you will, right? Some machinery in our guts to be able to resist or at least know when we're falling into just merely mimetic stuff. Now, you know, again, mimetic desire is not a bad thing. I have models of loving fatherhood, family life, you know, people that I want to catch those desires, right? I want to surround myself with those people and nurture and cultivate those desires. And in that sense, mimetic desire can be a powerful force for growth. But there's also negative ones. And I coined the word anti-mimetic in the book to describe the need to have the ability as a human to be able to resist always getting pulled left and right and up and down by mimetic desire when we might not want to. And that involves recognizing it for sure, but it's not enough to just recognize it. You also have to have the capability to do things. It's kind of like exercise. Like, I know what I have to do, but I'm just like not able to do it. I don't have the will. So anti-mimetic, I named it that first because there's a lot of stuff that didn't make it into the book. And an ongoing project for me over the next few years is just looking at ways that we as individuals and as a society may need to develop some anti-mimetic virtues, so to speak, in order to live healthy lives and to have a healthy culture. So, I mean, I look at kind of herd or mob mentalities taking over. I look at, you know, the kind of misery that getting pulled in a thousand different directions. Like my students often, college is a very mimetic place and they choose majors and career paths largely through mimetic desire. And I want to give them the awareness and the skills to have the self-possession, to be able to have a little more agency in their choices, to be able to cultivate thick desires. And anti-mimetic for me is just kind of a code word for combating the more negative or destructive aspects of mimetic desire. Not to transcend it or do away with it completely, but just to be the kinds of people that have the freedom to be able to choose a little more intentionally.
Well, I think that's a fantastic place to wrap up. But because I'm a terrible interviewer, I'm going to ask you one more question. And this is something you hinted at offline via email, which is celibacy. Can you talk about your celibacy and how that relates to mimetic desire?
Sure. Yeah, this is going to be a first for me in a podcast. So, you know, we had talked about via email about the sexual drive and how that is, it's not a need. Sex is not a need for a human being. It's possible to be celibate, and people have been doing this for thousands of years. So I'm no longer celibate, but I went through a period in my life, and I told you in the email, because you had, I think, pushed back on one of the points and said, well, you know, people can sort of override the sex, not a need, right? You can choose to not have sex. And I said, well, I know that very well, because I went a period of 5 years of my life being celibate and having sublimated that to other things in my life, because I was in formation to be a Roman Catholic priest for a few years and moved to Rome. And, you know, in a beautiful way, it helped me understand sexuality differently. You know, it helped me understand what intimacy means. There's an old monk in one of my first days in seminary stood up in front of us all and gave us a talk and handed us a sheet that had 72 ways of being intimate on it. Of course, one of them was sex. And he's like, guys, he goes, you got 71 of the things on the sheet are available to you. You better learn how to be intimate in all of those ways. So there's a lot that I could say about that, but that's something that I have some personal experience with, having something that I think, you know, is many people can kind of view as a need that must be satisfied, but can certainly be, you know, redirected or channeled into other things.
Well, that makes sense. Wow, that's hardcore, shall we say? I can't imagine doing that. So this is the central thesis of Chris Ryan's book, Sex at Dawn, is the primary purpose of sex in humans is non-reproductive. It's for social networking. Jamie Wheel came on the podcast and he talked about his book, Recapture the Rapture. And he talked about how sex was an important way to create meaning in our lives, you know? So I'm not sure I could really advocate for celibacy in building a rich and meaningful life, which is the purpose of this podcast, right? Like an examination of what it takes to live a rich and meaningful life. So I'm not sure I can advocate for celibacy, but I applaud you in your willpower. You know, if you could do that, you'd do anything.
Yeah, I will say, during those 5 years, I developed some extremely rich and beautiful friendships, especially male friendships. I lived in with a community of men in a way that I don't know if I would have, right, had I not sort of like learned intimacy in other ways. So it's an experience that I'm very grateful for, but certainly not something I would advocate for everybody.
Well, the book we've been discussing is Wanting, The Power of Mimetic Desire in Everyday Life by Luke Burgess. That's my guest. It's a book about why we want what we want. And where can people find you online, Luke?
People can find me at lukeburgess.com, and they can find the book, of course, on Amazon or wherever you like to buy books.
Excellent, excellent. And I'd highly recommend signing up for your Substack. I don't subscribe to many things these days. I take a rather minimalist approach, shall we say, to newsletters, but yours is definitely one worth having. So I'd encourage people to sign up for that.
I really appreciate that, Chris. Pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you. Thank you.